Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 15th of January 2013 here in Japan. It is the 14th back in Florida, where we're joined on the line once again by Dr. James Tracy, who of course runs the Memory Hole blog at memoryholeblog.com. He's been a guest on this program several times now, talking most recently about truth in the academy and talking about tenured professors standing up for intellectual integrity even in the face of overwhelming opposition. So on that note, it's very interesting to have Dr. Tracy here today. James Tracy, thank you once again for joining us.
Well, it's great to be here, James. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm not sure if listeners are aware, but I think they probably will become aware shortly. There's been quite a bit of controversy in recent days surrounding some coverage that has been given both locally and nationally to your Memory Hole blog and some of the posts that you've had up there about the Sandy Hook shooting. And it has generated quite a bit of controversy. But before we get into the media side of this and the way that your comments have been portrayed and perhaps taken out of context and reduced to sound bites, perhaps we should give you a chance to talk a little bit about your coverage of Sandy Hook and some of the questions that you have about what really took place there.
Yeah, I was not the first on this story. I wrote a piece on December 20th, just probably a week after our conversation in early December. And it was really building on something that the investigative writer Mike Adams at Natural News had observed about how the narrative was already being scrubbed. He wrote a piece on December 16th, and that was followed up by a piece by Rob Dew over at InfoWars. And about the time that I was actually looking at this and focusing on the missing gunman, the disappearing gunman, or at least the shooting suspects from the scene. So that's the first piece that I wrote. I became intrigued. I was really amazed at the fact that this was something that was overlooked by our news media. Not too surprised, but it was intriguing enough for me to continue in this vein. I wrote another piece three of the four pieces appeared at Global Research. There was another piece that I wrote. I had some extra time because I was on winter break, break for the holidays. And I wrote a piece that I published on Memory Hole blog on December 24th. Michelle Shazudovsky picked it up over Global Research the following day. And that was on another thing, a piece that more broadly addressed Sandy Hook and not just the unusual circumstances of disappearing shooting suspects, but other sorts of anomalies that just can't really be easily explained away. There was a piece that I wrote about a week after that, talking about the extent to which perhaps this may have been at least partially staged. I realize that that is controversial, but I do provide, I believe, some compelling evidence with regard to that theory. And then finally, because I received some feedback on that, the people were kind of, how could you say that? I decided to do a timeline in the vein of what Paul Thompson did, for example, with the 9/11 timeline over the course of, several years that eventually became a book. This is a much more modest attempt to really look at what was taking place with Sandy Hook in the time leading up to the event and subsequent to the event, and what the many inconsistencies are in the reportage. You take, for example, the shifting types and number of weapons that were used. You take the commentary by by who I referred to as the accidental medical examiner, H. Wayne Carver III, who really isn't quite aware of what's going on at the postmortem. So there are all of these inconsistencies. Also, for example, the interviews with bystanders, parents and children, seem somewhat stilted in some cases. There's also photographic evidence documentation that I think that any competent researcher would have questions about. Coming at this from a media studies, journalism studies professor, I am at a loss as to why these inconsistencies, these anomalies, really just an absence of information in some cases was not really picked up on more so by the by our media, our news media.
Well, unfortunately, as we've discussed in the past, perhaps that shouldn't be surprising given some of the egregious abdications of journalistic and professional responsibility we've seen with incidents in the past, like the Lusitania and Gulf of Tonkin and other such incidents. But of course, those are firmly in the past, and at this point, it's not very controversial to raise questions about that. But in the wake of something that is so fresh and so tragic in the minds of so many people, obviously, this work is really touching a chord to start asking these questions now, precisely when it is most important to be asking questions about this coverage. So for people who are really hearing about these inconsistencies and problems for the first time, perhaps we could just go over some of the most glaring inconsistencies that you've seen in the reporting on Sandy Hook.
One of the things that I point to is the press conference with the medical examiner, which I mentioned briefly a moment ago. I was looking at that, and I noted that there were a number of independent researchers who had pointed to that in YouTube videos and so forth. And I looked at the whole press conference. It's only about 15 minutes long. Now, if you take in that press conference with a few sound bites and with some imagery of the medical examiner before the microphones and flanked by the state police, and it seems it's somewhat impressive. But this is the impression that one gets. When you look more closely at the exchange, at what was being said, at his remarks to fairly basic, routine questions that one would anticipate hearing posed to a medical examiner, There's some real problems. So, for example, the coroner is not able to identify how many boys and how many girls there were that were among the slain. Is not able to identify the types of bullets that were used, but only in rather vague terms. Where the specific bullet wounds occurred, where they were on the bodies, what positions the slain were when the murders took place. All of these things are left unanswered by the coroner, so one is left to conclude, there's something much more going on here that meets the eye. Now, if I were a parent of one of the slain, or if one of my loved ones was one of the adults that were killed in the tragedy, I would have some very, very pressing questions as to why this is being accepted at face value and not being scrutinized more so. People have said to me, "Well, you're being disrespectful of those who have lost their lives," but I think that the performance of the medical examiner is far more disrespectful than anything that I've said by simply raising questions about this. So that's one particular thing. I had mentioned the disappearing shooter suspects. That's another. This is something that was picked up by aerial coverage, I believe, gathered by the Associated Press. And along those lines, that aerial coverage of the aftermath of the event is very, very telling, because you may have seen coverage of the Taft High School shooting back last Thursday. And it's very clear that there was an evacuation of several hundred students in the aftermath of that event, because they flood the sidewalks. They're all over around the school, and this is picked up on video footage. This is hardly the case in the aftermath of Sandy Hook. At least that footage is not forthcoming. We don't have it, so we don't really folks that are leaving, the children, the staff, what have you, that are being evacuated from Sandy Hook, are really few and far between. It's almost as if it's the site had been previously vacated. At least that there's no photographic or very little photographic or video footage to suggest otherwise. The convergence point following this and for triage and so forth was set up at the nearby fire station. And yet there's very little activity at that fire station either, at least with regard to the video footage that I've seen. And it looks as if inside the fire station there's not a great deal of activity. So one would think that this, I think the news media and so forth sought to portray the magnitude of the event, that this type of imagery would be forthcoming. Now, that's also the case with regard to interviews with individuals, interviews with bystanders. And in many cases, there are recurring figures. There are recurring parents, recurring students, and only a handful of these individuals. There's the rather unusual succession of interviews with alleged Sandy Hook resident Gene Rawson. And it's just turned out that it's just come out that he is a member of the Screen Actors Guild. But someone did a rather skillful, they put together a number of interview passages with Mr. Rawson, and he's saying almost the identical things, which would lead one to suggest that he is more or less reading from or reciting the lines that he has memorized from a script. If one takes these things episodically, when they're, for example, passing through the living room and glancing at the television, it might not seem that unusual. But if you look at these things more closely, sit down and address them, there are very clear problems. That, again, as I had suggested, there is the possibility that that there were actors that were used. Now, I know that that's controversial, and that is not to say that a tragedy did not take place. But that it may have been choreographed or channeled in such a way as to determine the impression, the interpretation that one took away from the event.
Well, I certainly do hear what you're saying, and what you're saying sounds quite a bit different than the context that the media is putting it in when they're attempting to portray what you're saying. So often what is being portrayed in the media, for example, on Anderson Cooper and others, is that you are saying that this is a completely fictitious event that didn't happen. And what it sounds like you're saying is that there is a lot of room for discussion about what did or did not happen, and that it hasn't been properly answered by the news media. But to be fair, there's a huge difference between saying that nothing took place or it didn't take place at all in the way that it was supposed to, and that the coverage of it has been manipulated. There's quite a big gulf between that. I guess the question is, what is the burden of proof then for establishing that something did or did not happen? What would you what would satisfy you that the events took place at all and that they took place in the way that the media is saying they did?
Well, that's a good question. I think that one would actually have to send in investigative journalists or the equivalent, an independent investigative team to interview Newtown residents at random, perhaps. And this is something that's actually been suggested to me by some readers of my blog. You know, why don't you go up there and interview people yourself? I mean, that's not within my immediate purview. The initial reason I became interested in this case was because I thought that the news media did a poor job, and I still think that they're doing a poor job. But I think that. If they had performed better, and I know there's not necessarily any historical precedent for that, but if there were a greater variety of individuals that were interviewed, the autopsy records and so forth were forthcoming and were made available, those types of things, I think definitely would put a lot of things to rest. But what the public has to go on is this limited performance with, for example, the coroner that leaves a lot of questions still unanswered, and actually brings up more questions than it does settle. So those are a few of the things. We also need to know, for example, the identities of the shooting suspects that attempted to abscond from the scene. And what were they doing there? Now the law enforcement had half-heartedly come out and said, well, one person was a disturbed parent, and another person was just happened to be up in the woods by the school chopping wood. Well, if that's the case, then they must have come down to the school for a drink of water or something and then been chased back up into the woods. So these things seem rather implausible. And if, in fact, the person who was escorted by parents and bystanders by the police to the patrol car stated that I didn't do it, how did they know what they didn't do if they were merely innocently chopping wood nearby?
Right. Well, but as you indicate, this would be almost a remarkably simple conspiracy to unravel if there was even one person who was interested in going to Newtown to actually interview some of the residents there to try to establish what happened. It seems like not only would that be extremely easy to unravel, but it would unravel at almost every point. I mean, if there were actors being used to portray people in the media, one would expect not only that they would have to cover that up, but the people who know these actors and the relatives of these actors, etc., would also have to cover it up. It does seem like a mind-bogglingly large extent to imagine that this type of fakery would go on. What do you say to critics who would talk about that, those types of problems with this idea?
Well, if that were the case, there is an organization called the Crisis Actors. They work in coordination with the Department of Homeland Security on events such as this. Perhaps not live events. They are adamant in that they work on shooter drills. But in some cases, as we've learned from the past, there's a very fine line between a drill and between a live event. You look at, for example, the work of Webster Tarpley on 9/11. He talks about there being as many as 15 drills taking place at the time of 9/11, and it doesn't take a great deal for some of these drills to actually go live. So I would imagine that individuals involved as accessories to the landscape here might not actually be aware whether or not at least until the aftermath whether or not something has gone live or not, nor are they in any position to actually determine whether or not something goes live.
Right. Well, I understand that. I'm just kind of sensitive on this topic because there are actually people who have claimed on the internet that I am, in fact, a person, an actor living in Arizona who is portraying a person who is living in Japan. So I understand there are genuinely mentally deranged people out there who will jump on these types of incidents to try to posit these types of theories about basically everything and everyone, and I imagine it's only a matter of time until people start claiming that you are an actor and that you do not, in fact, live in Florida, etc., etc. And it raises the question to me of how do we actually come to any type of understanding about things that we do not have direct access to? And it's a kind of a silly point at one level, but it's actually an interesting philosophical point. I mean, I have never set foot in Bulgaria. I don't think I've even flown over Bulgaria. I know nothing about Bulgaria except what I've read in books and what I've seen, what pictures I may have seen or videos, etc. But for all I know, it could be a vast conspiracy that's been created to convince me that there is a country called Bulgaria. How do I know that there is a Bulgaria? I mean, it's that type of thing that we have to think about when it comes to regards to this, which is why I ask the question about what is the burden of proof for this type of incident. It seems to rely on a logical fallacy. The absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. So at what point do we start to say that this, in fact, did not happen the way that it's being portrayed?
Well, I think there's an impulse, you know, for us as a culture to defer to expertise in order to help make sense of the world, whether that is law enforcement expertise or medical expertise or what have you. And I think that's the case with regard to Sandy Hook. People do not wish to actually have their worldviews or their belief systems, if you will, called into question. And so when someone actually comes along and does that, it makes them rather uneasy, because if they actually do question something and find that there is some validity in those that are critiquing the official narrative, they have to make a decision. And that might not be the decision that they originally had, and it might be uncomfortable for them to actually take a stand. So I, with regard to the more philosophical question of establishing, you know, what is real outside of actually being at that event, we are at something of a disadvantage. Because to, you know, to a certain degree, almost everything that we come in contact with outside of our immediate experience is mediated. And so one of the best defenses that one can actually have in terms of in terms of grappling with the variety of stimuli one is confronted with is to think critically and to attempt to obtain their information, one's information, from a variety of sources, not just one. And I think that, for example, is what writers such as yourself in the alternative media, writers and producers, if you will, do in the alternative media, and why you are informed as you are is that you make it a point to actually look at a variety of reports on a particular phenomenon. So if you look at what is taking place in Syria over the past several months, one would have a very different worldview if you solely looked at the New York Times and the Washington Post versus looking at Iran's Press TV and RT, which provides a totally different sort of take on what's going on there. By looking at all of those media, you develop a more well-rounded view. And you also, I would argue, kind of get a you can develop an awareness of where the propaganda or the propagandistic efforts are emanating from. And, you know, that's the case, I think, with regard to a geopolitical event or set of circumstances such as Syria, as much so as with regard to the mass shooting and tragedy at Newtown.
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, we talked last time about truth in the academy and academia and people standing up for tenured academics, etc., and their right to make controversial statements and to push these areas that few others are willing or able to go to. So I applaud you certainly for standing up for that and continuing in the face of much criticism on this particular subject. Let's talk about the way that this really has generated such controversy and the types of the media attention and other attention that it started to generate, for not only for yourself, but obviously for your university and for academics in general who are in a position like you.
Well, I'm not new to being interviewed by the news media, by, for example, the local news media. In graduate school, I was, kind of a social activist and was fairly outspoken and the like. So, but those things I don't think were quite as controversial as a mass shooting involving a large majority of children. This is has a tremendous amount of emotional baggage. And I was contacted by a regional newspaper here, by the Sun Sentinel, and spoke for about overall probably an hour or so with the reporter, and I probably should have been a bit more wary, maybe in terms of the ways in which I was addressing certain things, but I was being as frank as possible. I don't think that I really had anything to hide. And I think that the reporter really did, I think that it was spun in a particular way. The idea that, well, this individual is an academic, they have a reputation for conspiracy theories and what have you. And that was generally the lead, which was rather sensational. And that I was questioning Newtown, that I had questions about 9/11, Oklahoma City, the Kennedy assassination, and what have you. And so that's how it was framed, how this rather nutty professor was calling into question, God forbid that we do that in a democratic republic, but calling into question what actually took place there after spending a good deal of time ruminating over the event and the news coverage. So that was a week ago today, and within the course of 48 hours or so, it became really an international news story. It was in the UK's Daily Telegraph or Daily Mail, I believe, and because Drudge picked it up, and it went from there. So I was getting, you know, contacted by broadcast journalists and what have you. Some national media as well. I've not been able to really field all of the interviews. I have a preference for being able to speak to, you know, in alternative outlets such as yours, because we can expand on ideas and things are not reduced to a soundbite or two that make the, you know, the interviewee look kind of silly. And this is something that I discussed about, you know, I discussed over with my my family, with my wife, and you know, boy, there's a big difference. Because it's amazing how the news media will take just a few words and really just blow it all out of proportion. And I don't believe that, I'm quite certain that a majority of people have not actually read the essays that I wrote. I have written four essays over the course of you know, between December 20th and January 5th or so. Now I've had a lot of hits on the blog, you know, daily in the tens of thousands. But there are many millions of people who are coming in contact with this story, you know, hundreds of millions. And just a small fraction of those people have actually gone to my blog, and most likely to Global Research and some of the other alternative news sites, to actually read what I said. It's just a matter of saying, well, he's a conspiracy theorist, he's saying this, and he's saying that the event did not take place, and he is causing, you know, undue grief to the survivors and what have you. And of course, it's a little bit more complex than that, I think. And I've said this to some outlets that I have spoken to. If we really do want to honor the deceased, we want to find out what took place. And in that regard, the authorities are not really acting in a responsible fashion. So it's up to citizen journalists to raise these questions. I must say there were a few quote unquote mainstream or, you know, news media outlets that have been quite good. WLRN, the local public radio affiliate, the reporter contacted me and said, I'm sorry to hear that, you know, you've been misunderstood. Well, that's generally how the lead is with regard to most of the news media. It's like, you've been misunderstood. We want to understand what you meant. Then when the camera goes on or the story comes out, they're asking these questions that are just, you know, these gotcha questions rather than actually spending some time to talk. I talked with this NPR journalist, Rick Stone, who put together, I thought, a wonderful story that was, I think, put me in a more favorable light than some of the other stories. And then, I teach media studies, and so some of my students who were involved in student media on campus, who've taken some of my classes, for example, a conspiracy class or, you know, journalism criticism class, they've come out with pieces in the student media I guess to an extent defending me or attempting to set the record straight in terms of there being more than meets the eye. More than meets the eye with, you know, just a couple of nuggets to use to sensationalize what I'm attempting to say.
So in a sense, the coverage of your story in particular is kind of a microcosm of the larger picture of exactly what it is that we're looking at with regards to Sandy Hook or some of these other events, in terms of the way the media takes certain sound bites, certain little factoids, puts them in a certain frame, and that becomes the establishment narrative. And only the people who are really digging deeper in towards the actual source material will ever find out that perhaps that isn't the full story.
Right. Yes, and I think that in part is why the authorities, the powers that be, if you will, they can more or less do as they please if they are able to control the media narrative. And I think that there's an understanding that there is a limited number of ingredients and quantity of ingredients in being able to do that. So this is to a certain degree evident. And at the same time, there aren't very many events, I don't think, that have been scrutinized to this degree. You know, this early on, 9/11 was something where you had really kind of a collective intelligence community, if you will, from just a variety of perspectives that were piecing things together and did a wonderful job in really, you know, revisiting that event because it is so significant. And yet the major news media they still cling to the dominant to the official narrative that this was something that was carried out by Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. So much so that it actually does continue to influence events to this day. So when you had the takedown of Osama bin Laden at his lair in Pakistan, this is something that becomes part of the dominant narrative, even though there are questions with regard to the veracity of that case itself and why the military or intelligence would go and kill this person and then dump their corpse in the ocean when here's the terrorist mastermind of the 21st century.
Exactly right. Well, again, there's just so much to talk about on these regards, but I know you're a busy man. So is there anything else that you'd like to say to people who perhaps are encountering yourself or the Memory Hole blog for the first time about these events or what we can take away from this? Is there anything positive perhaps we can take away in the fact that these events are being questioned with more vigor and more rapidity than they had been in years past?
Well, I think that there are a handful of researchers who you know, are looking into Sandy Hook, and one cannot say enough about the importance of the internet in this regard. Platforms such as YouTube and blogs, really to mull over and to debate what exactly is going on. There's a lively discussion going on with some of the Sandy Hook articles on my blog, and you know, I make it a point to post most comments as long as they're not profane and wholly irrational, as long as they contribute to a debate. So I think in that regard there is a cause for some hope, provided that we do have the internet. And this is a tremendous, you know, with regard to things such as Sandy Hook, we're talking about a real public safety concern that affects a lot of families. So we need to know what's actually taking place and get to the bottom of what is taking place.
All right. Well, once again, I do applaud you for sticking to your guns in the face of a lot of criticism and a lot of widespread attention over this issue. And I certainly hope that some academics will pay attention to this example and hopefully stick to their guns on various other issues as well. Once again, Dr. James Tracy, people can find your work at memoryholeblog.com, and I hope they will go there for more information about what you have actually written and said about Sandy Hook, rather than what is being portrayed in the mainstream media. Dr. Tracy, thank you again for your time today.
Well, thank you, James. Great to be with you again.